Okay, so I think we have to bring Ola back on screen so she can participate. Mm-hmm. Is she still there? Are you still with us, yeah. Ola, somewhere?
I'm here. Yeah.
Do you want to remain in the dark or be on the full screen?
Well, I can see you now.
You can see me, but we can't see you.
Oh,
now we
right.
can see you. Can you see yourself?
I can see myself. Can you okay. see me now?
Wonderful. I think we have about half hour more for a discussion now. I mean, because we started half hour late, please give me a sign if I should kind of round it up a bit earlier. These were two absolutely fascinating talks, or three great talks, and I'm still processing of what we've seen and heard. And I was especially interested, or what I found especially fascinating, were your everyone's reflections on educational spaces as shelter, but as opposed to enclosure or walling in these educational spaces. And about the discussions, both in Ola's talk and your talks, about how to define and conceptualize a shelter and how to actually provide shelter to children and educators with the available means. And this, clearly, it also revolves what is defined as progressive or desirable for educational spaces. So in Ola's presentation, the idea of open space or using open spaces and different types of sheltering from rain or sun were kind of seen as something that is not so progressive, maybe not so desirable, but then again, can this be turned around and turned into something that is even more more desirable than that solid schoolhouse imaginary? And in your talks also, there was you discussed a little bit, or maybe not so explicitly discussed it, but the uneasy relations, let's say, that I found in talking about traditional knowledge about forests in some way, and defining anyway the forest as our friend, something that is able to produce a new and progressive type of knowledge that will enable people to thrive in the forest, of the forest, but still, still with kind of definitions of backwardness and sort of defining certain things of the past as something that is not to picked up as a tradition to build on, or a type of knowledge to build on. I'm not sure if that's very clear, but I would be interested to ask both Ola and you to reflect a little bit more along these lines on these ideas of shelters before I open up for some questions from the audience.
Well, I can start then, since I really like the other two papers as well. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. But, I mean, I think the issue is also the semantics of what the outside is, because it's interesting. It's certainly in the English language, you talk about the jungle. It's pejorative. You talk about the forest, it's got much more progressive relationships. And I wonder whether, as they were pointing out, oftentimes for the African psyche, you're moving out of the forest or jungle to development and so on. And I think what's really interesting about Cabral is he's sort of saying, you know, there's a lot to be gained from the forest or the jungle. And indeed, you shouldn't be afraid of it. It actually very much supports us and develops you, which actually is the narrative that we're talking about today when we're all talking about sustainability and using local materials. But I think certainly, indeed, if I go back to kind of educational history, and it's interesting because obviously the whole of the coastal West Africa was colonized by the Portuguese as well. So Lagos is actually a Portuguese name. We have Rio de Sombrero, all sorts of Escravos and so on. They're linked both to the slave trade, but also Portuguese colonization. But the idea was always that you left the, well, the village is the way we look at it, to the town, which was the new development. And indeed, that's where the education was. So even the missionaries would sort of often separate themselves from the traditional neighborhoods and build their own mission compound. So I think that link to going back to the, like back to our roots is very important. And I think maybe in my paper, the issue is that I guess intellectually, certain groups are more willing to begin to relink to the outdoors than the traditional feeling, which is close away the problems of the outdoors and stay indoors, which is more developmentally sanitized. So it's a really interesting tension, is what I'm saying.
Thanks.
So thinking about the idea of the shelter, if I want to expand the idea of the shelter a little bit more, or at least in the concept of PIGC and militant education, the school becomes a shelter, not just a shelter as a place where I'm studying, but what I'm studying, it became a shelter of what is going on in the world and how it's preparing me to come out of this shelter to the world. For example, nowadays on the school manuals we study colonialism, imperialism, and so on, has terms that doesn't really affect our lives. And at the time of PAGC, it's so progressive, it's like this is part of our lives, this is an ongoing project, an ongoing process that is going to affect us daily, especially when we achieve independence, because we have to understand the liberation struggle in two aspects, the independence of the country and the liberation of the man. So the school becomes this shelter for the shelter for protection of what is coming of the outside, but also a shelter that prepares you to the outside of thinking about the world in the future.
Absolutely, and I think to add to this thought, I mean, two things. One is also the mangroves are also the places, the natural shelters for many species. Most of the species of fishes and oysters that live in these areas, they put their eggs in the mangrove roots, and actually it's the place where big fish cannot access, and it creates a chaotic labyrinth network that actually is a creates this protection. At the same time, parallel to that, I mean, we have been talking with many of our colleagues and kins, as we say, our comrades, because we've been working for so long now on these issues, and we have been discussing also the importance of even today creating safe spaces, because, for example, in Guinea-Bissau, where we are working a lot is there are for example, the neocolonial or the neoliberal pressure, for example, in the youth is so intense that people are not, they don't have any more the capacity of reflecting what is actually happening with them.
They don't have the shelter.
Is that so? So once you create these kind of spaces, this kind of like spaces where you gather and you start reflecting, what are the tourist operators doing, or the oil the exploitation, and also when you, or the politicians or their conditions of life that is completely out of place. When you create spaces where people can reflect and discuss together and put the subjects on the table, and when you create these spaces, it's a way of like protection, and I think we can extrapolate it directly, I think, because the struggle is not over yet and the war goes on. So that if you extrapolate it to what's happening now in the wars of today and in that time, creating a space where children could read, think, discuss together in the context of a permanent stressful adrenaline loaded condition of life. It's a super important moment of creating your own subjectivity.
Thanks. Questions from the audience. I'm actually blinded by. There's Tom.
I have a question to Ola. Hi, it's Tom.
Hello.
Hi. I was struck by one thing you said pretty early on in your talk about the way in which the more experimental kinds of spatial design and pedagogies are being distributed only, I mean, among the bourgeois expat scene in Nigeria or in Ghana and West Africa at the time, because you're bringing in the notion of class here, or the concept of class, which is of course in this case very closely related to the question of colonialism and the way in which class is being there are class boundaries within the colonized population, but there's also the class difference between the colonizers and the colonized, and how this is kind of playing out in the very designs of schooling and of school buildings. Could you elaborate on that a bit, because this I think is a crucial aspect we haven't touched upon yet.
I'm happy to do so. I think, I mean, it is very interesting that originally the colonists came in, as I said, from the missionary times right up until the 1960s, where particularly in British-speaking West Africa, King's College Lagos was very much the kind of Eton stereotype. It had the building, it had the facade. You could say the same thing about Achimota College. So these were the government colleges, but even the missionary colleges, they're very much built in the image of European colleges of the time. And you have this situation where post-independence, I think very much the case that I think for the average Nigerian or Ghanaian, that was what they aspired to. But in a way, intellectually, the discussion begins to develop further, particularly actually originally in the universities. So you have actually a new breed even of British architects. Fry and Drew and co. were much younger architects than the colonial architects of the time. And they bring in an international style. So you're sort of seeing that international style playing its way through in the international school I showed you as a case study. And then interestingly, we have other actors. So we have Sharon coming in from Israel to help build the third university in Nigeria, the University of Ife. I mean, there's a whole set of politics around how Israel, at a time when Nigeria was allegedly in the Cold War, and much more aligned with the Arab states than with the Israelis. But anyway, Sharon comes to build the University of Ife. It's a very interesting interpretation of, I would almost say, brutal modernism, late modernism. He's very much looking at environment and climate, but he's also beginning to, again, experiment with space. So unlike even the University of Ibadan, which is about 10 years earlier, he's much more into experimenting with spaces in terms of indoor, outdoor, using the climate more. But again, the universities were for the elite. Your average person who's trying to get his son or daughter to school thinks of a school as being this space that is bounded. The setting is the setting that they can remember really probably from missionary days. And it continues now, because when I was writing my book, I could plug the book, can't find it. If you look at the Aga Khan schools, Aga Khan colleges in East Africa mainly, they have a lot of use of outdoor auditoria. They begin to talk, I'm thinking particularly about the Aga Khan College in Mombasa. It really links to the old Swahili architecture, and so on. But to get into the Aga Khan school in Mombasa, I did actually ask. The majority are, again, expatriates, upper middle class. I think they have one or two scholarships for the poor. So again, intellectually, in terms of class, it's still that development of a neoliberal viewpoint of education that is much more experimental, that a certain group of Africans now are more interested in. But the average African is still looking at schools very much as it was, as they were delivered actually prior to independence. And there's also a reliance on these materials which are not sustainable, which is the other narrative. So neither the education nor the materials are really moving with the times.
Thank you.
Please, Sabine Bitter.
Hi, thanks for that really great presentation. I have a quick question to Sonia and Philippa about the title of your project called Militant Education. So I was wondering if you refer with this also to like militant research, or maybe if so, if you also could talk a little bit about the way that the process of how you make this film, that would be very interesting.
I'll start with the first one, first question about militant. Militant education, actually, the title was the name of a seminar or a discipline for students from the first and second grade of on PRC school program. And that was what gave origin to the name of the book before even mention about militant research. As an activist and as a social political activist, my work was always militant, but I was not expecting during my research to find the term militant education so clearly like so explicit in a school manual. Like today we won't talk about that. When I mentioned about militant education, we are talking about political education, not like how we understand in today, like you become some part of a terrorist group or so. It's a political education that we are talking about, anti-colonial and decolonial education. And this was work that I was already doing before I start my PhD. And I was very surprised to find this on the archives research, and I decided to give the title of the book, the first title, Militant Education, Liberation Struggles and Consciousness. Actually, you can read in on the opposite way, first consciousness, liberation struggle, and then militant education. That is a whole process. So concerning the militant education, is that's it. You want to answer the second one about the title of the film?
We only have a working title.
A working title.
I mean, I think one aspect is maybe because we see our work in a certain condition that is not it's not a post-colonial condition. It's a colonial or a neo-colonial condition that I think it makes it a bit different, that the work that we do is not just historicizing, you know, the past, but it's actually about getting tools to struggle in the present. So, and this is important because we don't think, you know, there is such thing as the end of colonialism. So, and I mean, the work that Sonia has done in communities, you know, for years, and you know, passing to, you know, you're changing your setting, but you're doing the same work. So it's not, and this is, so it's actually trying also to work with the tools of the subjects that we are working about, or at least trying to recuperate and see how can we adjust certain tools that were used and what is still valid and useful today. And for example, parallel to this work that we're doing as a film, we are also creating a space there that is this, you know, with our collective, that is a space exactly that it's going to be a non, you know, it's not going to be connected with the PAGC, because today's PAGC is, it's a name, but it's not the same thing, but it's about informal it's an informal educational space and a safe, what we call a safe space to discuss and to work. I mean, I even have here your concept of militant education, if you want to read. I don't know. I mean, I think it is the one that you had in your book. But concerning the, I mean, at the moment we have only like a working title called Learning from Rhizophora. And the idea is not that the people were learning in the mangroves, but that we are also learning from this process, you know, we are learning with the research and with the film. So it's both. They were learning with the mangroves, but we are also learning with the process. So it's actually the idea of both.
Just to add a little bit more of, just to add a little bit more about the process of militant education. During a work that I was doing in Portugal, I was working with students, black students, Afro-descended students, and they were complaining about the way they were being represented in the school, and they were saying, like, we don't have a history, nothing appears in the school book. And it's like, no, something must be there, something must exist. So I want to give them another idea of what a school book could look like. And it was through this combination between me working and their raising questions. I remember, when I was doing my master, I actually found some material related with the education of PIGC education, and that's how the project actually started. It was in a militant way of I have to give something to. I have the means to present something new and something that will create some more self-esteem on these students, and it was in this militant way that I start this project, and is in a militant way that me and Filippa, we work in everything that we've been doing in the past 10 years or so.
There's also one little aspect that it's important, because I think there is a difference between this demystifying that we were talking about, the fears of jungle, and also the animistic aspect of Guinea-Bissau's population and in relation to nature. I mean, I think that sometimes it can confuse, because for example, I think also Cabral was working within this kind of animistic relation with nature. And also with the, you know, like, even if you would call, for example, in scientific terms, for example, working from he talks about this edaphology. You know, edaphology is like the one of the two sides of soil science that is actually how the soil intervenes or reacts on the beings on it. So it's actually a, you know, from the soil, like kind of a subjectivity from, you know, like what that comes from the soil up. And I think it's not it's a complex element, but it's, you know, he was also talking about the importance of connecting modernity and animism, you know, like, and bringing together, you know, like he also when he talks about the sacred entities, the Irans, you know, the Guinea-Bissau, like they talk about Irans as these sacred entities that are always connected with nature and the trees and how they were also militant in a way. So he actually creates this relation. He really says that the Irans of the jungles of the sacred jungles, they were on the side of the struggle. So in a way. And this is, I have a little quote here from Eduardo Viveiros de Castro that really talks, I mean, because it's complex to go into this, you know, to find, you know, words and sentences to relate to this. But he says in a very interesting, he says, like, what interests me is the possibility of reintroducing the past to the subject, which doesn't have to be idealistic, but is a materialistic theory of the subject as a material subject. So we have the heroic tale of humanity conquering nature, which is an alterity form from the point of view of culture as a modern soul, within that distinguishes us from the rest of creation. Whereas among the Amazon Indians, it is exactly the opposite. In their views, we are all in the world. Humans merely have a particular materiality. What makes us human, as such, is our body, not our soul. Our soul is the most common thing in the world. Everything has a soul. Everything is animated. You see animism. So in a way, it's actually about, and this is a little bit what we are searching through the film also, like wow, the film can be also, because it's also an animated image, or not a being, but a device, no, something that has its own anima, and how can we find, you know, a way of bringing all these forces together, you know, like how can the, you know, the mangroves become this kind of force and that animates, and also it has a knowledge itself, it emanates a certain kind of possibility of being within, yeah, yeah. And thinking within.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Right. I was just wondering, so the work you're doing on Guinea-Bissau, does it link to what then becomes the movements in Southern Africa? So, you know, the ANC had its own schools in exile. Sometimes, I think it went right to Tanzania and then sometimes the border of Mozambique. Or is it purely and uniquely for Guinea-Bissau and Cabo Verde?
I start to do the work focus on Guinea-Bissau, and right now I'm working on the concept of militant education in an international way. How can we see it, for example, how can we see the extension with Mozambique, for example, that I'm working now with Mozambique, and then with Ghana, also with the Black Panther movies, the Black Panther Party in the US and the indigenous movements in the US too. So I'm trying to see how the work of Cabral and the militant education, how this is spread and how it relates around the world, and South Africa too, of course.
I was thinking particularly in terms of the architecture, the idea about, I guess in Nigeria we call it schools in the bush. Mm-hmm. So, for example, during the Biafran War, 1966 to 1970, there were these schools for the refugees as they were moving, as the Nigerian army was closing in on Biafra. And actually, interestingly, coastal, back to this thing about us sharing the same geography of the coast. Mm-hmm. A lot of the coastal communities would have had the schools of these mangrove areas and so on. So it's that idea about the shifting school and the transient nature of these schools that I'm particularly interested in.
It happened also, you can find these kind of structures also in Zimbabwe during the second Chimurenga. So okay. These structures, somehow during liberation struggles in Africa, they are very well, very related in terms of how they were built and how they were transferred from place to place. So this is something that I'm exploring right now, seeing how militant education has his networks on of how this liberation struggle combines in the terms of education, and across, not just in Africa, but also across the ocean.
Great. Because I think, again, just discussing that a bit more, the idea about the actualization of the space and the place in comparison to now what we have, which is kind of refugee camp education, which again is very aid-driven, I would say. Whereas in this case, I think particularly listening to Cabral in your clip really gives you the idea that, you know, this space may not be seen as something, but it's part of the, you know, you're adding, you're including the situatedness of the space to the kind of education that's taking place, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something that is kind of an interesting aspect. There was very recently a conference of environmental education in the Bisagos Islands, like an international conference, and they didn't include one Bisago people to talk about their relation to nature, because the interesting thing is the fact that the Bijogos, for example, that is this ethnic group that are on the islands, they have this very particular aspect that they're sacred. I mean, they sacralize places and nature on the islands as a way of protecting them. And this is actually so there's no so religion and environment and nature protection. They are always connected. They were always connected. They are living there for the past 1,000 years. And it's very interesting because they actually are the ones that can tell us about, they can educate us about how to protect nature, but they are not given a voice, even if the conference like that happens there. So this is actually a very interesting kind of like connecting with this idea of the aid and what kind of this kind of aid concept is doing, you know, like and projecting onto these places.
May I add just one thing related with what Philippa just said about the nature and with the text that I showed about the forest, our friend. This demystification that Piaget is trying to do is a way also to protect the forest, because once you demystify the forest and you create the respect for it, in the period of development, you can have more respect and you can actually protect the forest from capitalist extraction of exploring it.
Yeah.
So we have to see it in very different perspectives, this idea of demystification of forest and how one relates to nature, which was what Piaget was doing during this period of militant education. Respect and what can you extract, but extracted, but from in a conscious way.
One more. Oh, okay. I don't see any more hands. And I think we've had a very, very rich discussion. And I thank very much Ola Oduku, Sonia, and Filipa for these wonderful talks and discussion. And everyone... and everyone who lasted till now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ola.